for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Just hours after President Bush signed into law revisions to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the ACLU filed a lawsuit challenging the legislation. Ted Kennedy made a dramatic return to the Senate to cast a key vote on Medicare and a top aide to John McCain's presidential campaign calls America a nation of whiners, drawing a quick rebuke from the Arizona senator. Joining me to talk about these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, Juan Williams of NPR and Fox News, Lynn Sweet with the Chicago Sun-Times, and John Harward with the New York Times and CNBC. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning,
Diane. Morning, Diane.
John Harwood.
Hey, Diane, are these mics hot?
Yes, okay. These mics are open, so just remember that. The WashingtonPost.com is reporting that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac have lost nearly half their value as the markets open. What's going on here, John Harwood?
What's going on is we're seeing the depth of the problems in our mortgage market, our housing market. The financial system's under tremendous amount of strain right now as a result of the bursting of the housing bubble. And it's left a big mess in the lap of Washington because these are quasi-governmental entities that have benefited from subsidies, implicit guarantees of their debt. And now the bill may come due and Washington may have to do something about it. And, of course, the Bush administration and others on Capitol Hill are contemplating how they might bail out Fannie and Freddie, how they might prevent the mortgage market from collapsing. John McCain said yesterday that Fannie and Freddie are too big to fail, and I think that's the prevailing view in Washington.
Lynn Sweet.
Fannie and Freddie have prevailed and have flourished for so many years because of what their competitors consider a very unfair advantage they have. They're a half-private, half-public organization. No one in the private sector has the benefit that they have of saying, if we fail in our mission, the government will back us up. I mean, we can't go to the Safeway and Safeway go to Congress and say we didn't make it work. Fannie Mae has always had that unfair advantage. There are some in Congress that have been dying to take it away. I think as a result of this mess, these organizations will get some kind of bailout. They'll be restructured. I bet if we're sitting here in the future talking about this, when it's straightened out, they will not be publicly listed stocks because they've been unfair all the time. So that will be one upshot of this. Meanwhile, I predict, mortgage rates could go higher. They're still pretty low. So if you're really thinking of buying a home with all this mess, it still is a time where you could get affordable mortgage rates if you qualify.
Juan Williams.
Well, you got to understand how big this is, Diane. It's just awe-inspiring if you stop and look at it. I think it's $5.2 trillion, more than half of all the mortgages in the United States tied into these two. So you take away their ability, and largely because the value of the mortgages they already hold have collapsed because of the subprime mortgage crisis. Turns out they were, many of the mortgages they hold were also not valuable because people can't make the payments. And if people can't make the payments, then the value of those companies goes down, and that's why Wall Street is bailing out on them. So then the question becomes, what happens? And they can go into what's called conservatorship, which is that the people who control them in the Treasury could try to exercise some control and then try to refinance them somehow. As Lynn was suggesting, it wouldn't be public. It wouldn't be about selling on Wall Street. And the other option then is for the government to just simply take them over, and it would become a fully government operation instead of what Lynn was describing as sort of a two-headed beast with one foot in the private sector and one in the public sector.
Juan Williams, NPR News analyst, Fox News political analyst, and author of numerous books. Lynn Sweet is Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. John Harwood is Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC. 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 I'm going to say that three times. And a reporter for the New York Times. He's author of Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Of course, yesterday, Lynn Sweet, you had Treasury Secretary Paulson talking about this, trying to offer some reassurance.
Well, the market didn't respond. The market dictates. The market rules. Doesn't matter at this point what any government official is going to say. When you have Fannie and Freddie stock in the single digits, that's what is going to matter, not what an official says at this point, unless they take some action. I don't even see what cutting interest rates could do. I mean, there's nothing in his portfolio that could make a difference in the mortgage market now.
Juan, the Senate has a proposed housing relief bill. What would that do?
Well, the housing relief bill is more directed at homeowners who have a problem, less so at the Fannie and Freddies of the world. So the idea is to give some relief to individuals. Now, it's interesting. There was a poll I saw just yesterday that indicated most Americans don't even think that should go through. They think that individuals who got into these, high-end deals or deals that, you know, come due as the interest rates increase over time, may have been involved in risk-taking that was unreasonable and that they should have known it, as well as the mortgage companies that were involved in issuing these subprime loans. So I'm surprised at that because I thought there was overwhelming sympathy for people caught in those circumstances, but maybe not.
And Diane, that bill illustrates some of the schizophrenia surrounding how Washington feels about Fannie and Freddie. Lynn mentioned that certainly on the right, Alan Greenspan, the Bush administration, some in Congress have been trying to push a tougher oversight limits on Fannie and Freddie, not let them get too big because of the potential risk they pose to the economy. And so this bill includes tougher regulation of Fannie and Freddie, but it also raises the size of the mortgages that they can buy and backstop. And so you've got one foot on the gas pedal and one foot on the brake trying to figure out it. When you have an entity like this, which is partly in the private sector, partly in the public sector, it's got some appeal to both sides, Republicans and Democrats. They have battalions of lobbyists around Washington. So many top government officials, Jim Johnson, who had headed the vice presidential vetting for Barack Obama, not anymore, was the head of Fannie. Bob Zelick, president of the World Bank, once a top McCain advisor. He was also a top official there. Many, many others. So this shows how complicated this relationship is and how difficult it's going to be for Washington to sort it out.
Also, right. Fannie Mae has a foundation that they have used effectively to put projects in the districts of House members. And you could see through that in a minute. It was just part of a official, what's a nice word I could use? It isn't the word bribe. What it was. People were getting projects from the foundation in their districts, and it was all part of a softening up and buttering up to lawmakers by Fannie Mae.
Well, one last point on this, which is that it's going to have bigger consequences than just
Absolutely.
The housing market, that if you start to think about it and the kind of thin legs that the economy is on already, that this will have impact on everything from construction to development and I don't know where you would stop in terms of saying, this could be a tipping point.
And while we're talking about the economy, what did you make of Phil Graham's comments yesterday, John Hartwood, calling the country a nation of whiners?
Well, first of all, big problem for John McCain.
Yeah, he distanced himself from it very
quickly.
Yes,
although that's not too easy to do. Yeah. Phil Graham's the national co-chairman of his campaign. I think it in a very uncomfortable way for John McCain, dramatized some of the ideological difference, the difference in approach that the two parties have. There's a reason why we've called Republicans the daddy party and Democrats the mommy party. The Democrats have been more inclined over the years to feel your pain, try to do something about it. And Republicans have been the party of tough medicine, discipline, pull up your bootstraps and take charge of your situation. Phil Graham, in a very impolitic way, was expressing that difference, that they are the free market party. They are inclined to think And we certainly saw this over the past couple of years. Certainly in the 06 campaign, Republicans were going around saying, why are people feeling so bad about the economy? It's really doing well. We were growing. Corporate profits were good. Now, what makes these comments so impolitic now, although they're consistent with what Republicans have said in the past, is that now the economic problems are manifest in $4 a gallon gasoline and what we're seeing right now in the market in Fannie and Freddie. And so it is the danger for John McCain is that it sort of puts in sharper relief that difference that Barack Obama was already going to try to capitalize on in the general election.
Juan, how do you see it?
Well, you know, one of the efforts going on right now in what seems to me is a chaotic McCain campaign is to try to focus on the economy and try to make it clear to people that he is sensitive to what's taking place out there and has some knowledge, some experiential knowledge of understanding, if you will, Diane, of the economy. This directly contradicted that strategic move on the part of a campaign that's struggling to find its feet. So this, to me, was undercutting the message, and it's a very thin message. I mean, if I asked you or anyone in this room, you know, what is the message of the McCain campaign, I think we'd all be kind of at a loss. So here they were saying, you know, we're going to focus on the economy as a way to try to appeal especially to independent-minded female suburban voters and all that. And look, all of a sudden, here comes Bill Graham saying, no, you know what? You guys are just whining. It's a bunch of complainers. Look at the unemployment rate. Not so bad. You know, look at Wall Street. Yeah, Wall Street might be having, but it's not that bad. And therefore, what's everybody complaining about? They talk about the opposite of feel my pain, Bill Clinton's mantra. This was it.
So I think Phil Graham ought to be listed as an in-kind contributor to the Barack Obama campaign. Because they will know what to do with this. Actually, he also said you've heard of mental depression. There's a mental recession. You know, you hear this constant whining, complaining about the loss of competitiveness. Obama yesterday knew what to do with it. He hit this line out of the ballpark. Nation already has won, Dr. Phil.
Lynn Sweet, she's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with NPR News analyst Juan Williams, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, and John Harwood, a chief correspondent here in Washington for CNBC and a reporter for the New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. It wasn't just Phil Graham who made impolitic remarks yesterday. What was Jesse Jackson thinking? Juan Williams.
Well, just to recount for the listeners, Jackson basically suggested that Barack Obama be castrated because Barack Obama had said once during a Father's Day speech in church that black fathers should take more responsibility for their children. And also that Barack Obama had suggested that possibly a faith-based initiative, the Bush program, would be continued and should be more fully funded to better deliver social services to those in need. Apparently, Jesse Jackson didn't like these ideas, to put it lightly, and then came out with this off-mic sort of comment to pick up on John's little joke at the start of our program, where he apparently thought that he was on Fox doing a thing about health care and then made an aside to Reed Tuckson, who would be known to people here in Washington, D.C., as the former health commissioner here, about Barack Obama and this desire to make him a eunuch. And I thought it was, you know, so incredibly revealing, Diane, because it was something, you don't use language like that, you don't say something like that, unless you really feel it and you feel it passionately.
Anger,
oh
anger,
my God.
Anger.
So here was a moment that was so, I think, a sort of moment of truth coming out about the way Jackson feels about Obama.
What about Al Sharpton? He hasn't been terribly sympathetic to Obama either, John.
Right, and Barack Obama's delighted about that. You know, Barack Obama is somebody who right now is trying to persuade white voters, blue-collar white voters, some of the Democrats who didn't support him in the primaries and independents, that he's an acceptable candidate. It is just fine and dandy with Barack Obama to be getting criticized by Jesse Jackson. And I've got to say that if you could have, you could not have contrived a scenario to illustrate Jesse Jackson's lack of political potency, if you will, because you had not only Barack Obama distancing himself from Jesse Jackson and Jackson, as Juan said, indicating how angry he was. Then you had Jesse Jackson's own son come out and talk about how ugly and divisive his father's rhetoric gave him the crazy old man treatment. And that just shows that Jesse Jackson is now marginalized. Barack Obama is the guy, not only in the Democratic Party, but also in the African-American community politically. And that's probably doesn't feel very good to Jesse
Lynn
Jackson.
Sweet.
There's a backstory to this, and that is basically Reverend Sharpton and Reverend Jackson have done Obama a favor by keeping a low profile through all these months. But it does seem that Obama has his problems with ministers, you know, Flager, right, and now Reverend Jackson. But Reverend Jackson, if I could do a little political psychoanalyzing, I think feels a little pained, too, that he has not been called upon in any way by the Obama campaign to help in any public way. His son is a co-chairman. This actually is the second time that Rep. Jesse Jackson Jr. has rebuked his father. Reverend Jackson complained in a op-ed, he's a Sun-Times columnist, about Obama not doing enough for urban issues. And Jesse Jr. wrote an op-ed. So the relationship between father and son here goes into play. It's very painful, too, to see this. It's because I've covered both of them for many years, and it's generational. But the Obama campaign was portrayed in a very wonderful and wicked satire by Saturday Night Live in a cartoon they had a while back, where Obama sent Sharpton and Jackson a very important mission to like nowhere on the earth, and kind of had them sent hither and yon and then dumped out of an airplane. And it was very funny, but in a sense, he had to maintain the relationship, have some respect, make him feel included while not including him. So some of this frustration, I think you saw boiled over on a very human level, too.
I think this is also a preview that if Senator Obama was to be elected president of the United States, this is a real difficult psychological moment for the likes of Jesse Jackson and for people who would buy into Jackson's view of the world, which is that Barack Obama should be putting pressure on the federal government and saying to the federal government and to white America in general, you still owe black people, and that black people have been victimized by this country. And Barack Obama, I think, is just sticking his toe into the water in terms of asserting the notion of personal responsibility over something like fatherhood or what's going on in the schools, and saying we have to take some responsibility, that it's not just about how many people are in jail, but black people have to really turn away from this criminal kind of attitude or acceptance of crime in the community, gangster rap and all that. And all of a sudden you see the Jesse Jacksons of the world say, no, you can't say that. You're not following the orthodoxy. That's not the message we want delivered, and therefore you are to be punished. I think with the idea of seeing a black man in a position of power where you got to play political games, you got to strike compromises, Jackson, the Sharptons don't like it, find it threatening to them.
I don't know. I want to be a little contrarian, respectfully so. I'm kind of translating the psychology here. I am guessing that Reverend Jackson thinks that Obama could have had a more nuanced, program and platform that doesn't. What people hear, and I know this is kind of maybe a racially oriented appeal. They hear personal responsibility. Don't eat cold fried chicken for breakfast. Make sure you read to your kids. Stop watching TV. That is not aimed at the audience he's talking to. I heard him give this sermon several times to predominantly African-American audiences in person, but it's really intended for a wider, probably middle-class white audience. Yeah. I just think that Reverend Jackson thinks, why can't you incorporate in that message that government still has a responsibility to help the down and out?
All right. We've got to turn now to other actions. The president yesterday signed into law an overhaul of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Did he get everything he wanted, John?
Not everything, but he got the better of the House and Senate Democrats in that deal. The Democrats simply made a determination in the end that they weren't willing to have a drawn-out fight with the Bush administration over security. And Barack Obama acquiesced in that. This is something that is politically advantageous for him to get off the table. He took a little flack on the left, which is also probably good for him politically because it casts him as not on the fringe of his party. Very interesting that Hillary Clinton, his former rival, voted against this bill when Barack Obama voted for it. I'm not sure that doesn't help Barack Obama to be seen as to the right of Hillary Clinton on this issue, even though MoveOn.org and some of the people associated with them will smack him.
His web page. I mean,
they used all that social organizing net roots have used it to show their displeasure. But Diane and my colleagues, this is good for him because these voters will be angry, but I don't think he's going to lose them in the end. One thing it does show, this one was the most clear about face that Obama had. He could argue endlessly about how he really has been consistent about Iraq, and we could parse what he says Talmudically and sit and puzzle over statements if it means a shift. I think on this one, this FISA compromise, he has changed from what he said, and giving this conditional immunity is something he said he was against.
Well, let's just be clear about this. One, he agreed to allow the telecommunications company not only immunity now, but retroactively.
That was a key
issue. That's the heart and soul of it, right. Which is why I think the president basically got all he wanted. The only compromise element here from the Democrats' point of view is that they will now have to go to a FISA court, which is a secret court, foreign intelligence court, in order to, before they go about, you know, mucking around in telecommunications, phone calls, emails, all the rest.
So what about Barack Obama's flip-flop on this issue?
You know, I think, you know, there's a clear record here of flip-flopping now. Everything from his position on the D.C. gun control ban after the Supreme Court. He said he supported it. Then after the Supreme Court rules against it, he says he supports the Supreme Court to FISA. You can go on. It just seems to be a series of these. And, of course, the political theory here is that he's moving toward the middle, trying to win the middle. But at some point, you have to say, well, exactly who is this guy? Because he is defined by the Republicans as the most liberal senator in the U.S. And I think the way that he ran his primary campaign to defeat Hillary Clinton was to say, I stand for something. I am not a mealy-mouthed average politician. I am beyond post-partisanship. I'll tell you what I believe. I'm going to stand for it, and specifically on the war in Iraq. And it's gotten to the point that even the New York Times editorial page is saying, don't you try to run to the middle and compromise anymore. Otherwise, you're no longer going to be Barack Obama.
Well, he said in this week something like, and I'm paraphrasing, people have not been listening to me. I have, and I've been following him for a number of years. This is who he is. He's somebody who straddles the fence and lets you, as he has often said, create the impression of him that you want. And that's why when you go and, again, Talmudically study some of his statements, he will find wiggle room for all of this.
It's kind of hard when you say, I'm going to end the war in Iraq. And then all of a sudden you say, well, I'll reassess and I'm going to go visit Iraq and I'm going to talk to the commanders, realizing the commanders are inevitably going to say, we need more time, more money, more troops to do our
job. Absolutely. So that's what he understood would happen, and if you had the impression otherwise, that is because, as he would say, you haven't been listening. And this is, I think, very, very kind of his MO.
I disagree with my colleagues in part. I think there are some clear flip-flops. I think the campaign finance thing is the clearest one. I disagree with Lynn on the FISA thing. I think anytime you talk about legislation that has multiple parts, legislators have wiggle room to say, yes, I didn't get all I wanted, but I got some of what I wanted. In substance, though, he backed off what he said he was going to do on FISA. I think some of these things, there is more nuance to his position, and that's a good thing for Democrats, and it's a good thing for Barack Obama politically.
That's
Barack
why,
Obama
John, you
has
have to read the small type in anything he says. I don't think we're disagreeing.
Sure, right.
Everything
well,
he has
exactly
an asterisk
so, but
after
that's
what he
part
says.
Of what marks a good politician.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan allowed Republicans to see in him
so all I'm saying
what
is
they wanted.
People
Bill
who were
Clinton
the believers
allowed,
weren't reading the footnotes.
Fair enough. My only point is part of what we're describing in the Talmudic parsing that Lynn referred to, that's part of the sign of a good politician.
All right. Let me ask about McCain and his shift on some positions, Juan.
Well, you have McCain. I mean, the big one would be on the environment and on drilling. But what you see here is also McCain difficulty with an issue like immigration, because here he has been the guy who said, we need immigration reform, worked with President Bush and the Democrats, but then, of course, ran into a tremendous backlash from the conservative Republican base. Same thing on drilling. He's out of step with drilling. So he has been trying to flip-flop because he's trying to appeal to the base, which he has yet to secure, especially in terms of money, at the same time reach out to those independent voters he would need if he hopes to catch up with Barack Obama.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Lynn, what's behind the recent shakeup in the McCain campaign?
It wasn't working. And the campaign is behind organizationally. The Obama campaign took great advantage of this long campaign season. They had campaign structures in almost all 50 states because the primary went to all 50 states. McCain did not exploit the time he had between February and June, because he essentially knew for months that he was the nominee.
So what does he hope to accomplish by elevating Schmidt?
I will punch him off real quick.
Steve Schmidt.
Field. He needs a better field organization, needs a more coherent message. I think his organizational team has to get more people out doing net roots. Everything you need in a campaign needs to be cranked up by the McCain campaign, and they're competing against a very cohesive Obama organization that has this very, very unperturbable campaign manager in David Plouffe. Schmidt has to do a lot of just basic stuff that should have been done months ago.
John.
They have a very, very difficult task in the McCain campaign. The Republican base has shrunk. The Republican brand is way down. This is a Democratic year. They're fighting that tide big time. You have in John McCain a nominee of that shrunken Republican Party who was distrusted by the base of his party and at once has to reassure people on his ideological right flank and also reach out to the middle. It's very difficult. His message is inherently, if you're a maverick, message discipline is not easy to accomplish. You're going to look like you're zigging and zagging if you're true to yourself. That's John McCain's problem. Steve Schmidt is a very skilled message guy in a campaign, and he's going to try to impose some coherence, but it's inherently an incoherent situation.
Juan, let's talk about the Senate Medicare vote with Ted Kennedy showing up. What did his presence do?
Well, it literally made the bill possible, and I don't know if you've been to your doctor recently, Diane, but I've been to mine, and I got a little lecture before I got any treatment about the idea that there was going to be this 10.5% cut in Medicare payments, and what that would mean, and that, you know, possibly doctors would stop taking Medicare patients, and it would be a real cut for and hurt doctors all over the country, and what's the government doing, and all the like. And you had a vote earlier, I guess late last month, a vote in which I think it was 59 senators voted in favor of it, but that wasn't enough to filibuster-proof it. And what you had was the White House and the Republican leadership in the Senate saying this bill is going to cause problems for some of the insurers. It's going to pump up the amount of money that they would have to pay.
And even as the vote was about to take place, the vice president was having lunch.
Oh, yeah. And Vice President Cheney was reassuring people that, in fact, President Bush would veto this. Don't worry about it. Not going to happen. And then, I guess it was just after 4 p.m., here comes Ted Kennedy, accompanied by Caroline Kennedy.
And his wife.
And it was so emotional. I mean, I don't think Republican or Democrat, you could have had anything but the thought, my gosh, here's a guy making a tremendous effort at this point to save a bill on an issue, healthcare, that has been central to what he has done in his time in the U.S. Senate.
And be the decisive vote.
Well, not just the decisive vote, but garnering other votes that wouldn't have come from Republicans, John.
Sure. And what Democrats were doing here was a classic sort of wedge play, trying to force Republicans to choose between two Republican constituencies, doctors and insurance companies. And they pick the one that is most politically popular, the doctors. Insurance companies are not popular. There's an ideological overlay here because it goes to how much of the Medicare system do you want run through private companies as opposed to through the government. And they forced that trade-off and they won.
He immediately left. Ted Kennedy immediately left. The vote, 69-30. So what happens now? The White House vetoes.
They can't be. It's veto-proof now. So it will go into action. And what's interesting, by the way, you mentioned, Diane, Vice President Cheney's presence. You should know 18 more Republicans joined after Cheney was there. So
joined with Ted Kennedy
with the Democrats
and the
on
Democrats.
This vote.
All right, short break. When we come back, time to open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the American College of Medical Genetics, ACMG, translating genes into health. At acmg.net. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Iran's test firing of medium and long-range missiles draws rebukes from the U.S. Iraq's prime minister proposes a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. And the International Criminal Court considers war crime charges for the president of Sudan. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And now let's go to the phones for the Friday News Roundup. First to Lamont, Michigan. Good morning, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just have a couple quick comments and
sure.
questions. The mortgage, most mortgage companies have the ability to privatize through insurance their risk on most of these mortgages. I haven't heard much about the mortgage companies involved and why they weren't. Also, there's a stated income type of program where the lending institution will verify the credit score, the fact that there is employment, but they never make the next step to find out how much the people are actually earning. And I just want your panel's comments on why should we be bailing out these people, and if I voluntarily don't insure my house and it burns down, nobody comes after me, helps me out.
Well, this is what I was talking to you about earlier, Dan. I'm surprised at the number of people who feel that lots of individuals made mistakes and that they shouldn't be somehow supported by now the government's largesse, the government investing in the fact of their failure. I thought there was going to be an outcry of support for those who found themselves in this position, but with adjustable rate mortgages, and like you had lots of young people, lots of people who maybe should have realized that they were overextending themselves and wouldn't be able to meet the commitments. But also then, of course, there's a question about these big companies and Freddie and Fannie, and whether or not the government should be supporting them when they're involved in offering these subprime mortgages that have now become almost without value.
Here's an email from Scott in Cincinnati, who's listening on WVXU. He says, my wife and I intended to vote for Barack Obama, but were very disappointed by his vote to support broad surveillance and legal immunity for telecom companies when Senator Feingold and Spector questioned the wisdom of such a vote. Can this be the change we hope for? Is he trying to comfort those who question his patriotism? Senator Clinton voted against the bill, but I wonder if she would have voted differently had she secured the nomination. And how do you explain John McCain's absence when this came to a vote? Why don't you take that last part, Juan?
Well, John McCain was wanting very much to support the base of the party and the party's position, which was in support of President Bush and the idea that you would no longer have immunity for the telecom companies. At the same time, I think that he felt that he was under pressure to somehow challenge President Bush about the civil liberties issues, especially, again, as he's trying to appeal to that middle.
John, what do you make of this question about change and the theme that Barack Obama has used? Is this the kind of change we're likely to see?
Well, this is the email is an indication of the trade-off that Barack Obama faced. Does he remain on the side of people like that writer? Or does he try to signal to the broader public that I am not going to be a left Democrat on security, that I'm going to protect the country? And one way to try to signal that is to vote with and narrow the differences with John McCain on an issue like this. There's a potential problem for him, but I suspect that their calculation is that there's more to be gained in the middle than there is to be lost on the left.
And here's Wanda in St. Louis. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane. Hi to everybody who's there. I just wanted to say that I think coming from the position of an average citizen, that we put a lot of pressure on these candidates, both McCain and Obama, to stick to their guns in everything that they've said for their entire careers and everything that they've said leading up to this, with no room for reasoning. And I think that's what we've had for the last 8 years with the current administration, is an example of someone who says, it's my way, and I really don't care. I mean, they've almost literally said, I don't care what everybody else thinks. We're going to do it our way, and we'll go to any length to have our way. And so when Barack Obama or other people, or not other people, but McCain even, moves with the changes that are happening in the war or even in the country, you have to, as long as it's not a direct opposite, you have to say, okay, not that he's flip-flopping, but that he is intelligent enough to see that he has to be able to move with the events that move.
Lynn Sweet.
You say something reasonable, and these campaigns aren't rational, and blame them for taking out of the arena the ability for a calm, rational discussion. The Obama campaign reads and looks at and examines everything any of their opponents said during the primary. They are willing to jump on it. They are willing to exploit whatever misstep someone takes. There is no second chance. There's no taking back words. This is how I'm going to use a word called conventional. It's a very conventional tactic to go after your campaign, your opponent, and that's what ratchets this up. You know, the Republicans do it, the Democrats do it, the Obama people, you know,
well,
do
but
it.
And what that I hear Wanda saying is, I am beginning to look at things differently, and she may well represent a goodly number of people out there who are saying, you guys who are watching word by word by word. For God's sake, give them some room to analyze what their own positions are.
Well, then the question is, how do you decide who you're going to vote for? The idea is that you decide who you're going to vote for on based on people who would subscribe to some policies that you would feel good about.
Sure.
And so all of a sudden you say, well, I think the war in Iraq should be ended, and I can see that one candidate says, end the war, I'll get you out in 16 months or less. Another candidate says, no, we can't do that. Defeat would really damage America and damage America's interest and give the terrorists a victory. Here's a clear point of contrast. And suddenly, the guy who says we're going to get you out says, no, I'm reassessing. And you think back to why Hillary Clinton was defeated. Many people say just because she didn't take a strong stand on something like the war. So now we come to this point, and you say, people are saying, wait a second, we have to give an individual a chance to think about things, to be reasonable, to be rational, to look to respond to changes in society and developments along the way. I think that is really a cop-out. I think that's
I disagree with Juan. I don't think people make decisions to vote based on stacking up policy positions and comparing exactly where they are on issues 1 through 10. I think they make an assessment over time of the character of those people. To the extent they've changed, do the changes seem reasonable? Are they outrageous? Is it something that suggests that they've not been honest before? And I do think, to Wanda's point, the tenure of President Bush, who, for better or worse, has stuck to his guns very consistently on many issues, from taxes on the domestic front to Iraq on the foreign policy front, he has made flip-flops look a little bit more attractive by virtue of how unpopular he is right now.
All right. To Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to return to your first comment on Senator Graham. I noticed a big fuss about his use of the word whining, but very few newspapers or news organizations ever have raised the point that, one, his wife was on the commission that deregulated natural gas. She then took a job on the board of directors of Exxon and became a very wealthy woman. She then had the very good fortune of leaving Exxon before it collapsed. And that Phil Graham, throughout his professional life, has supported what, in my view, becomes the excesses of capitalism by depriving Americans of some reasonable regulation that can prevent these raids that cost millions of Americans their health care benefits, their pensions, their jobs, their livelihoods. And yet, the media complain if they cover superficiality, and they don't seem to go into some of these other things.
Look, Phil Graham and Wendy Graham have been part of the point of the spear, if you will, of a shift in American politics and political economy over the last generation,
it's
which
what
is
what you talked about earlier.
Yes, which is from an economy that with more government intervention, more regulation, to one with less. And so it is not surprising that Phil and Wendy Graham have been advocates of deregulation across a range of American industries, nor is it surprising when they leave government that they go into the private sector. That is in the nature of what free market actors in our political system who then leave it will go to do. And I don't think it's been entirely ignored, though.
All right. Here's another related question. Mario in Cincinnati.
Yeah, just a quick point. First, I think the gentleman once mentioned not Exxon, but Enron before. And my thought is, again, how the media is covering this mental recession comment and how and compare and contrast it to how Alan Greenspan came out and said that the country was going through an irrational exuberance with regard to the stock market. I think making the case that there is a mental component in just how lightly and from a political lens that they're using to look at it, but not really from a critical thinking lens.
Lynn.
Yeah, you're right, but he wasn't involved in a big-time political campaign, and he wasn't an advisor to a presidential candidate. That's the difference, too.
Well, it's psychological. There's no question the markets are psychological. And
sure.
And the idea that Freddie and Fannie for years had the backing of the U.S. government, that's in part psychological, because now we see that when their holdings go down, the government so far hasn't been there. The idea is that, right now you could say, the government's going to either buy stock in Freddie and Fannie or bail them out altogether. but that hasn't been sufficiently a boost that would psychologically then allow the market to revive. As you said, Diane, at the start of the show, their stocks keep plunging.
John Harwood, let me ask you about Karl Rove. He apparently defied a congressional subpoena. Yesterday there was an empty chair. Talk about what he was called on to say.
Well, the Democrats are trying to explore what has been going on with the in the wake of Scott McClellan's book coming out, talking about the Scooter Libby case and also the controversy over U.S. attorneys. All of these things the Democrats are trying to exploit and play some politics with. Karl Rove's contention is that he was not legally obliged to respond to that subpoena, and so his lawyer.
How come?
Executive privilege. And, you know, this was the contention while he was in the White House. And he said that he had been instructed, his lawyer said that he'd been instructed by the president, not having a legal obligation to respond, he'd been instructed not to show up, and so he didn't. And he's going to challenge the Democrats to come get him.
Right. In fact, and so in a week you may have a subpoena issued by the committee, but don't forget Fred Fielding, the White House lawyer, said he is within his rights, and he has a letter from Fielding saying that he should not be testifying.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Dover, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Joanne.
Hi. Thanks. I wanted to say to your panel, who I've listened to many years, you guys are really intelligent. You're really well-informed. But I'm disappointed.
There was a but there.
Yeah. I'm disappointed in the quality of the discussion on presidential politics, because I think that you've borrowed some very simplistic terms like maverick and flip-flop, even the terms liberal and conservative. They're old. They're old school. They're commercialized terms that were used in the last election to sink the Democratic candidate. And I think that stepping away from childish language like that reduces your capacity to make critical analyses in your profession, would be a good thing, not just for you and your careers, but for the country. And in particular, let me take the two presidential candidates. We label John McCain a maverick, so that any inconsistencies in his position, any change in his position, is part of that wonderful, you know, yippee-yi-yo-ki-yay.
Joanne, I appreciate your points, and I wonder what your reaction is.
Well, she's wrong. I mean, clearly, if you were a Republican and you had to deal with John McCain on things like campaign finance legislation or treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, you'd say, this is a guy that doesn't stick with the party. And we can't rely on him, and that's why he's called a maverick. It's not just a yippee-yi-yo-ki-yay type of image.
Here's where I think she's right. I think that, and I agree with Ron on that point, I believe that John McCain can legitimately be described as a maverick. But it is a reality of our modern media that we tend to reduce circumstances to labels.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the 24/7 news environment, those labels get repeated over and over and over.
Right.
It's not always fair to the people involved. Not always fair to the voters.
And quickly, I understand your listeners' frustrations.
Yes.
But sometimes this is not inaccurate. If you look at a record and you see where somebody is, you can put a label on it.
Juan Williams, on Tuesday, many members of Congress attended the funeral of Jesse Helms. How is he going to be remembered?
Well, you know, from the conservative point of view, he'll be remembered as someone who fought strongly against communists and communists in Cuba, communists in the former Soviet Union, and stood tall. You know, Senator Ngo on a lot of State Department issues, State Department appointments, William Well, the former governor of Massachusetts in particular, I think people will remember. I'll remember him as the guy in the campaign against Harvey Gantt going back now some time. Ran a commercial in which he had a pair of white hands crumpling a piece of paper and saying, you were qualified, you should have been given that job, you needed it, but they had to give it to the minority. The guy who refused to attend Nelson Mandela's speech to a joint session of Congress. He practiced racial politics and appealed to what I think of as the conservative, small-minded views of people in the worst way. And, you know, you could say it was racial politics, you could say it was racist politics, but he lacked the optimism of a Ronald Reagan in terms of advancing conservative agenda.
Neat and sweet.
He had battles against the National Endowment for the Arts, and he had a famous tussle with Caramel Zebron on the Senate floor. Yeah, so he just, you name whatever hot-button issue, and I think he was on the wrong side
John
of it.
John Harwood.
Our colleague David Broder called him the last openly racist white politician in the country. I think if you look at the record, it's hard to argue with that judgment.
And sexist.
John Harwood, Lynn Sweet, Juan Williams, thank you all so much.
You're welcome, Diane.
Thank you.
I'll be off for a few days next week. Be back with you probably around the middle of the week. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.